Continuing education credits for physicians and other healthcare professionals is provided by VCU Healthcare Continuing Education. Check out cribsiders.vcuhealth.org for more information.
The Cribsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and informational purposes only. The views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host.
Welcome back to the Cribsiders. I'm Chris the Chew Manchu, and I'm here live from APNCE, which stands for National Convention and Exhibit.
Exhibition.
Yes, close.
With a bunch of my friends, which is awesome because some people, like Sam over here, even though we've worked together for years, we've never met in person. It's crazy. Same with Abram.
Yeah.
So, guys, want to say hi?
Yeah. Hi, I'm Joan.
Hi, I'm Sydney.
Hi, I'm Sam.
And I'm Abram.
So, I'm so excited. We don't have any guests tonight because we're all the guests because we're awesome. So, Joan, before we get into the crux of everything, do you want to tell us about the show?
I would love to. We are the Pediatric Medicine Podcast, and usually on the show, we interview leading experts in the field to bring clinical pearls, practice-changing knowledge, and answer lingering questions about core topics in pediatric medicine. But as Chris said, today we're coming from the AAP conference in Orlando, Florida, and we're going to be sharing some of our top pearls from the first couple days of the conference.
All right, so are we doing Picks of the Week?
I think we should do some Picks of the Week. There's nothing better, especially since we're all here together for this conference.
We should start off with a trainee.
Fair enough.
How does Abram know that's him automatically?
Well, I mean, throughout my career, I've always been told to read more, and I finally picked up a non-medicine book lately. I read Small Rains by Garth Greenwell. It's about a poet who gets stuck in the ICU, and it's about his experience as a relatively intelligent person and really knowledgeable person, his experience interacting with healthcare. Is really lovely.
Oh, nice. Nice. Anyone got any good comments about poetry? I unfortunately am not.
I only know AI poetry. For anyone who makes it all the way to the end and sees my AI poetry... Here's a plug to make sure you go to all the way to the end for all our episodes. So, all right, Sam, you next.
All right, mine's a little bit of a different vibe. So the media that I've been enjoying right now has been podcasts, but unfortunately this podcast has been sports-based podcast. I've been listening to the Games with Names podcast from Julian Edelman, the ex-New England Patriots player. And Cindy loves that. If she can't hear her on the mic right now, it is a wonderful podcast that I keep walking to and from work with. For all you New England Patriots fans or haters, it is essentially he interviews all sorts of old players, coaches, and even back office front staff like Ernie Adams and Bert Najarian. So lots of interesting things to check out.
So is it like Travis Kelce's podcast?
It is, just a lot less famous.
Oh.
But it is also awesome. And I will say, the reason why I listened to New Heights, the Travis and Jason Kelce podcast, was because Julian Edelman went on and I listened to his episode. And it actually was quite good. And so I started listening to their podcast too, but that's all right. shout out New England Patriots.
It's Sydney.
All right. I have another podcast recommendation. So we are a podcast recommending podcasts. The podcast I would like to recommend is called Raising Parents. It is a pretty new podcast with Emily Oster, who I am a major fangirl of. She is a economist who studies parenting. And Raising Parents is a podcast that very much geared at parents, goes deep into the data on some of kind of the biggest questions when it comes to parenting. So her most recent one was about discipline. And I think as a parent and also as a pediatric provider, that's something that I'm constantly asked to weigh in on. So it was really nice to have this kind of balanced, data-driven approach.
Yeah, I love Emily Oster too. I will say she gave me a lot of validation when she said it's okay to go back to work, because sometimes with hour three or four with your kid, not as good as hour one or two versus hour three and four. Work is about the same as it's been at hour one or two. And so she gave me validation. So I appreciate that.
Well, you, Joan?
My pick of the week is a little bit of a cheat because I haven't actually started this yet, and it's not a podcast. It is Pachinko Season 2. I watched Season 1 and loved it, and Season 2 just came out. I'm very, very excited. For those of you all who don't know, it's about a Korean family that immigrates to Japan during the war, and it kind of documents this like multi-generational saga, which I really, really loved as an Asian American. I think I, at one point in my life, was like, who's writing stories of like, you know, Asian American history. I feel like we learn about Asian history, we learn about American history, but like, what about the Asian American immigrants? And so I think kind of touches about that since it's Korean immigrants to Japan. So very excited to start that when I get back home.
Wait, so this is a live action show?
Yes. Yeah.
What's it on?
Apple TV.
Oh, Apple TV.
Yeah.
Oh, Chris, do you happen to happen to have Apple TV?
By accident, yes. Ted Lasso, guys. I guess my pick of the week is chili mango, dried chili mangoes, because they taste amazing just and healthy. So I don't know.
Fueled by dried chili mango.
I feel like that is literally the perfect segue to the first talk we're going to discuss.
Americans take about 20,000 breaths a day and spend an average of 90% of their time indoors. The indoor air that we breathe can be up to 100 times more polluted than outdoor air, according to the EPA. Indoor air pollutants can cause respiratory symptoms like sneezing, congestion, scratchy throat, and even more serious health problems like lung and heart disease. So what's the solution? Air Doctor, the air purifier that filters out 99.99% of dangerous contaminants so your lungs don't have to. This includes allergens, pollen, pet dander, dust mites, mold spores, and even bacteria and viruses. So let me tell you how I've used my Air Doctor so far. It starts and ends with diapers. We set up our Air Doctor in a small room with our diaper pail, and it takes the smell out of the room. I don't know if I can say that clearly enough. It took away the smell of diapers in the room. I feel like that speaks enough for itself. So, Crips Addicts listeners, we have a few offers for you. First, Air Doctor comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so if you don't love it, just send it back for a refund minus shipping. Second, head to airdoctorpro.com and use code CRIB, and you'll receive up to $300 off air purifiers. Exclusive to podcast customers, you will also receive a free 3-year warranty on any unit, which is an additional $84 in value. Lock in this special offer by going to airdoctorpro.com. That's AirDoctorPro.com, and use promo code CRIB, CRIB.
Who's doing this one? Who's talking about GERD?
Yeah, so Sam and I went this morning to a fantastic talk on GERD. The title was A Burning Topic by Philip Bishop, Chief of Pediatric Gastroenterology at University of Mississippi Medical Center. And in addition to recommending that you tell patients to avoid things like chili mango, there were a lot of more subtle pearls that I really took away from this. Sam, you want to get us started?
Yeah, I'll get us started. So just for everybody, we do have an episode on GERD. It was number 75 with Dr. Carlo DiLorenzo. He actually recorded at AEP 2 years ago. So shout out there. So why did we all go back for this GERD episode? Or sorry, for this GERD presentation after obviously learning so much about GERD? One of the things that we were trying to get was a little bit of practical tips. Like, so if you learn from Dr. DiLorenzo, you know, you probably should thicken the feeds for an infant with GERD as the first line piece. But we're like, we went to go do it in practice. We're like, how do we do this? And so Dr. Bishop actually taught us pretty well about how we could go about implementing these guidelines in young infants and a little bit older kids as well. So just a couple pearls for the infants. So how to thicken the feeds. So she was saying most people don't put enough low arsenic, cereal in their milk. She says you really need 2 or 3 teaspoons per ounce to get the right viscosity. This should be like a milkshake level viscosity to the point where it's tough to get out of this nipple, and you might even need to cut it or use kind of a special feeding nipple to do so. The problem is if it's that thick as well for these infants under 3 months, you might actually be worried a little bit about hydration status. So she was saying, hey, you're going to thicken with 2 to 3 teaspoons per ounce, get this really thick viscosity, but you can kind of give it every other feed if you like, just to make sure we get an appropriate water content otherwise. So I thought that was a super helpful pearl and something that was like actually how to go about and do this. Sydney, maybe we can just popcorn back and forth between what we learned. I'll give you another one after, but what did you got?
Yeah, so I think one of the pearls that I took away was the fact that babies who spit, now we're moving away from infants, but babies that are spitting up more, there actually is a very strong correlation with those becoming the adolescents who have reflux-like symptoms. It's a 4-fold increase in that prevalence. And so that is a huge part of the history taking. And if you have preteens with things like nausea or reflux or not reflux or like heartburn or other symptoms, asking their parents, were they a spitty child, can really help you to narrow your differential there, especially for the more obscure or wider differential presentations.
And did they mention anything about diagnostic testing or anything like that?
Oh my goodness. So much about diagnostic testing, most of which was honestly not what people necessarily want to hear, either patients or pediatric providers, which is that there's not a lot of evidence for much of any of the diagnostic testing. Basically, in the absence of red flags, there's really no reason to do any form of diagnostic testing whatsoever. If you're doing diagnostic testing, it's because you're looking for a complication for the most part. So, or you're looking for something that isn't GERD, because you're not going to see GERD on a diagnostic test. So what you're looking for is there pyloric stenosis? Is there, I'm totally forgetting the other complications that we were looking at. Sam,
no, I can jump in there too. Cause what she was pretty much saying was your diagnostic testing is for excluding other things. So this is a diagnostic of exclusion. So the upper GI was like her favorite test, but not to look for GERD. It was upper GI to look for malrovid volvulus. It's looking for a pyloric stenosis, look for any congenital abnormality. That's why you go ahead and get the upper GI, but not actually to go ahead and kind of diagnose GERD, so to speak.
Can I ask a question about these diagnostics? Are we talking about for infants and babies still, or for like our older kids too?
That's a really good point. It's actually for everybody, and we'll get into, there is for older kids, you can use therapeutics as diagnostics, but for the most part, diagnostic testing is for everybody. And then just to comment on that, most people are gonna ask, what about the EGD? Fantastic test. What does EGD look for? It can look for esophagitis, so a complication of GERD, but it cannot actually see whether you're refluxing up and down during that time. And then this is a little bit of a hard piece for everybody else, just for any of our ENTs that are listening. The red vocal cords do not necessarily mean that this is GERD. That's what she wanted to say. Dr. Bishop said that, not me. So not saying anything bad about our ENTs, but just so everyone knows that we should think a little bit twice before we necessarily just see red vocal cords.
Did she touch anything on physiologic reflux when parents might want to thicken feeds, but you might not find it indicated? I guess the issue being that you're adjusting the calorie content and the hydration of the feed you're feeding them. That's not necessarily without risk.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't say that she touched on that exactly, but she did talk a lot about physiologic reflux and just kind of the role that positioning plays there. And so I think my takeaway from that is that the first thing I would always recommend to patients is that positioning step. She described it, and I love this analogy of when the baby is lying supine, it's essentially you're putting a straw, their esophagus, into a puddle. And so things are going to come back up. And if you put them in a prone position if you put them in an upright position or a prone position, you're putting a straw into an air bubble and that allows them to burp and that prevents the reflux. So I would always recommend that as a first step. I think the other thing is what Sam's saying, where you can do a trial of thickening some of the feeds, but not all of them. But at the end of the day, it feels a lot more benign to me than some of the other treatment options that people might implement.
And that's a really good question, because also your kind of question is, what about the calorie content? What about that being changed, nutritional value and all that type of thing? When you add in the amount of rice cereal, I think the only thing you could possibly be doing from that angle is kind of slightly increasing the calories. And one of the things that you do watch out for reflux is overfeeding. And so then you're asking a question, oh my God, am I going to overfeed and all those type of things? And what she really recommended was small frequent feeds, and that being the main piece. And that's also another really low risk intervention, as Sydney was saying. And then there's the water content. I think we're going to have to do that play by play. I don't think there's something specific, but she was saying, as we mentioned earlier, kind of going back and forth between thickened feed, non-thickened feed. I can't say that 13 times in a row.
And then we're totally doing trials of PPIs in our infants, right?
You want to take that one, Sydney?
Oh my goodness. Yeah, right. Well, that's the other thing that I think people don't want to hear, but was very clearly emphasized, is that there just isn't evidence for a trial of a PPI in infants, either diagnostically or as a treatment. And this was something that we did touch upon in the episode with Dr. DiLorenzo, but there are a fair amount of complications and potential risks associated with trying PPIs. And basically what Dr. DiLorenzo said and what I have implemented into practice is, if you're at the point of recommending a PPI, that's really the point in which you should be involving a gastroenterologist, because you're worried about there being some other issue going on or some degree of complication.
And that actually brings us up kind of to the pathway of kind of the diagnostic through therapeutic treatment. I just wanted to touch on one thing that was kind of newer in the world of pediatric GERD. So we talked, number one, positioning and thickening the feeds. If that doesn't work for infants, the second line before we get to the PPI and the gastroenterologist is actually trying a hydrolyzed formula. So why would you try a hydrolyzed formula is a good question. So hydrolyzed formula does not fix GERD. Just want to be very clear to everybody there. But what turns out to be going on is that there seems to be it's really difficult, actually, when put it this way, it's really difficult to differentiate GERD from a milk protein allergy. They can present in a very, very similar way. And so therefore she was like, look, you're supposed to try 2 weeks of a hydrolyzed formula because maybe your diagnosis was incorrect and this actually wasn't GERD to begin with, but this actually was a milk protein allergy. And so you can try a hydrolyzed formula for 2 weeks and then go down the milk protein allergy pathway and then reintroduce this stuff later on as you might end up with a diagnosis there. And then the third piece after that would be, hey, considering a PPI or some sort of medicine, and that would be referring to a gastroenterologist, as Sydney said. And just to be very clear as the final piece, PPI is technically recommended over H2 blocker, just so everyone knows that is the new piece and the recommendation.
Did they say whether this was forever? Like, could you start with a PPI and then if they see me doing well, try to titrate down to like a H2 blocker to see?
Yeah. So again, depends on the age group. Actually, PPIs in infants are incredibly tough. So we're not even going to go down that road. One of the reasons is because, for example, you need to give it 30, 60 minutes before you're eating. And this infant who we want now to have small frequent feeds is feeding like every 2 hours. And how on earth are you going to get a medicine into this baby in between that? But for the older kids, yes, it's usually an 8-week PPI trial. And then afterwards you would try to wean down. And for the last reminder for everybody, and we've touched on this before, is that if it's been more than 8 weeks, please do not remove the PPI cold turkey. Because unfortunately, that will lead to a rebound situation because the proton pump ends up getting upregulated when you're blocking it. So then you're going to have a ton more acid right after that removal, unless you kind of wean down.
All right, are we done with GERD? Are we moving?
Are we done with GERD? There's no such thing as being done with GERD.
Depends. How many mango chili things are we eating?
I'm getting GERD right now thinking about it. So yeah. I think we need to move on so I can think about something else.
We'll just put you prone.
Are we talking about marijuana?
I think we're talking about marijuana.
I have no segue on that.
All the cool kids are talking about marijuana.
There you go. So I went to a talk called Marijuana and High Potency THC Products, What Pediatricians Need to Know. And this talk was given by Dr. Osterhout, I think that's how you pronounce his name, from CHOP. And I found it really helpful. I'm currently an addiction fellow with an interest in adolescence. So I think this talk was really relevant to me because oftentimes I feel like my patients come in and I feel like my counseling is like fairly limited in terms of how they can use marijuana safely. What are the things that they should be looking out for, especially with the legalization of marijuana. And so a couple of things that I thought was kind of helpful is, number one, even though marijuana is legal, because it is fairly new in a lot of states, it's not regulated. So if a package says, hey, these are like 10, these gummies are like 10 grams, it may be zero or it may be 20. You just like don't know how much THC is actually in the gummies, is number one. Number two, he made a point to say that a lot of the laws right now around marijuana is actually surrounding THC, which is Delta 8, like this specific formulation. And so a lot of people in the industry have found ways to get around these regulations by marketing other formulations. So like Delta 8 or like THC 0. And so there's no rules on that. And so that's something to counsel people on as well, that you might still have the same effects. He showed the whole hydrocarbons and, you know, I got PTSD from my OCHEM lecture, but they're very, very similar. It's like one double bond that's like displaced between Delta 8 and Delta 9, but there's all these regulations surrounding Delta 9, but none on Delta 8. And so that's another thing that we can counsel our parents on as well. And I think something that was interesting is that he showed several different papers that showed that the number of accidental ingestions of THC has just skyrocketed after the legalization. So I think he really put a call out to think about like, what are the regulations we need to have in place to make it safer for kids? Because a lot of these edibles look very colorful and small and exciting to our young kids. So is it that we need to have child-resistant packaging? Like, what can we do to make it safer for our kids? There's so much that I'm like very excited. I don't know if you guys have comments or if I should just blaze on forward.
Keep going.
Okay.
Yeah.
Here we go.
Learn some stuff.
The other thing that I thought was super interesting was, you know, last year I worked in the pediatric emergency department, and so often like we would have a patient come in and we're like, oh, it could be this, and marijuana. Like, is it marijuana because they're tachycardic? Is it marijuana because they are having some psychosis? Like, I feel like I didn't really have a good illness script for marijuana. And I do think that, you know, there's still a lot of research that has to be done, but he said common toxidromes, he said, was unresponsiveness, elevated heart rate, and large pupils. And some of the things that we get very worried about when you have a significant THC overdose is seizures or myoclonus-like activity, as well as respiratory depression. And it sounds like the jury's still a little bit out on kind of like the cardiovascular effects of overdosing on marijuana. And there was an interesting study that he pointed out that was published in 2023 by Denver Children's, which Colorado is a state where marijuana has been legalized for some time. And so there's a lot of regulations around it. And they actually looked at children who came in with THC overdose who were less than 6 years old and estimated that you can have severe toxicity defined by neurologic toxicity, cardiovascular, or respiratory toxicity if they ingest more than 1.7 milligrams per kilo, then you could expect to have pretty severe toxicity. So as somebody, I think, for people who are interested in toxicology or work in the emergency department, I think that number is kind of interesting to think about, though perhaps not helpful if we don't have regulations and asking industries to accurately depict how much THC is actually in these edibles.
Like, so dietary supplement style.
Yes,
that, like, exactly. It can tell you that there's 20 milligrams of this, right, but really it's zero or two or something like
exactly.
that.
Do we have any idea of, like, estimating, like, what are types? How much would we expect in, like, at one serving size of gummies? Like,
no, I think, so for Colorado, their regulation is, and I don't think I have it in this set of notes here. Oh, no, I do. It's 10 milligrams per serving and 100 milligrams per package. But for like Maryland, where I'm at right now, there's like no regulation at all. So you can't really estimate for the packaging, which is pretty dangerous for our kids and for doctors. It makes it kind of confusing as well.
Although looking at toxicity, then like a 5 kilo kid, for some reason, if they get into something they could be toxic.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Unless you have some regulated gummies or something.
Nevertheless, this is still going to be challenging because almost every kid who gets into marijuana is a kid who hasn't been. When it's not like we're watching them take it, right, in front of, right, oh, right, they only took one. You know, we're good. You have no idea how many they may or may not have taken. You know, as they just come to you and wake, and you know, classically they go to sleep and then don't really wake up the way they're supposed to, and then you're like, oh my god, what happened? And I'll go down that road.
Right, right, right.
Anything else?
No, I mean, I didn't put all my notes down, but I'm trying to think of other things. I feel like the regulations that he had brought up was, you know, maybe we say you can't advertise to minors, so people who are under 21. He talked about child-resistant packaging, maybe not make them so colorful and exciting for little kids to get to. And I think those are the ones that I remember. But he pointed out, I think Oregon has some pretty specific set of laws, as well as New Jersey, that might offer some guidance, because he did kind of talk about, on the flip side, if we say, and I don't know if this is too political, but in the flip side, if we say marijuana is not legal, then we kind of run into a lot of the social injustices that we get into in criminalization of marijuana, and how do we balance that?
I guess in your practice, though, how much of it with, you know, older adolescents, is it some kind of harm reduction thing? You don't know what they're getting, especially if they're buying these high potency products. Do you see that? How does that like bear out in your practice?
Yeah. So I currently have a primary care clinic for HIV positive patients who are adolescents and young adults. And I feel like my counseling now, I think, is going to surround on like, hey, are you taking these edibles? Let me just tell you a little bit more. You don't really know what you're taking. B, we know that it can cause, because I think I focus a lot on I think there was a study a long time ago that said if you take marijuana and you're less than 25 years old, it can impact IQ future on. So that's kind of the main thing that I quote. But now I think I can be like, hey, you know, there is like cardiovascular and respiratory risk. There is risk for seizures in addition to like the psychosis, in addition to mental health impact that you can have if you're taking too much marijuana. But I think from this talk, really, it's kind of, you really don't know what you're taking. So just be aware of that. And, you know, it's important who you're taking this with as well. Is it somebody who can take care of you if something goes wrong?
I have one last question. We can, if we didn't talk about this, we can skip it. Did KO talk to you about the urine drug screen at all?
So they, or he did, though he didn't go into super detail. He did say that, it was interesting. Actually, I wish I took notes on this, but he did say that you can buy a test, I want to say, at CVS that's fairly cheap, that you can run a test very quickly versus the hospital one costs like hundreds of dollars and takes a very long time to take, to come back. And then the other thing is he said that the THC test will come back positive, whether or not it's like Delta 9 or Delta 8, which kind of, I think, also points to the similarity of those different formulations. Yeah.
All right.
Spark something uncommon this holiday with just the right gift from Uncommon Goods. The busy holiday season is here, and Uncommon Goods makes it less stressful with incredible hand-picked gifts for everyone on your list, all in one spot. Gifts that spark joy, wonder, delight, and that it's exactly what I wanted feeling. They scour the globe for original, handmade, absolutely remarkable things. Somehow, they know exactly the perfect gift for every single person you know. I know Justin loves shopping on the site. There are lots of fun socks, knickknacks for that shelf that you were supposed to decorate, and plenty of art. The best part is when you are looking for gifts, you can search by interest, so you can easily find a gift for someone into food, crafting, puzzles, gardening, mixology, and the list goes on and on. And when you shop at Uncommon Goods, you're supporting artists and small independent businesses. Many of their handcraft products are made in small batches, so shop now before they sell out this holiday season. And so, Cribsetters listeners, to get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/cribsetters. That's uncommongoods.com/cribsetters for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods, we're all out of the ordinary.
What are we moving on to? Are we talking about gynecology?
Yeah, you know, another smooth transition. Yeah. I guess we're still in the world of adolescent medicine.
Yeah, we're really crushing these transitions over here.
Next time, we're going to need to like do a systems-based approach, like go head to toe, but we just...
Transitions are always Justin's thing, so that's not me.
All right. So, in gynecology.
Gynecology.
We're here. I went to a really great talk yesterday called Recognition, Evaluation, Treatment, and Referral of Common Gynecologic Disorders with Dr. Elizabeth Alderman, who is chief of the Division of Adolescent Medicine at the Children's Hospital at Montefiore. And I thought it was going to be every single possible gynecologic disorder in adolescents, which I think was perhaps ambitious for 60 minutes. We mostly talked about heavy menstrual bleeding, which is still more than a 60-minute topic. In terms of Cribsetters references, we had a really excellent episode on this with Dr. Angela Wayland, episode number 40. There were some similarities here, but also I think there were some pearls that, to me, it felt like built upon that episode and are probably practice-changing for me that I wanted to talk about a little bit. So the first thing that Dr. Alderman shared that I think is important for me to just know statistically is that only 67% of women will have regular periods 2 years post-menarche. So I often feel like there's this kind of like, okay, well, it's irregular because you just got your period. And then at some point I'm like, okay, it should be regular now. So it helps. I would love to know what the rest of that curve is, but even just to have that number of being like, okay, if they have continually irregular menses 2 years post-menarche, it is probably that there's a very good chance that it is just physiologic. So the main piece, and she went into the differential. There's a lot, I mean, I could go on and on about this, but I would suggest just listening to the really great episode. The main takeaway for me was really on how do you manage that heavy menstrual bleeding when someone does have moderate anemia, not severe enough anemia that you're sending them to the emergency room, that they're requiring a transfusion, but a hemoglobin of 8 to 11. And she was talking about giving the OCPs, the combined oral contraception, but she was suggesting that really you do the doubling up. So doing two pills a day until the bleeding decreases markedly or stops, and to continue to do that for 3 months to rebuild iron stores. And I think similar to what Sam was saying about GERD, this was one of those things that I had heard, but didn't really have enough education on exactly how to do it to feel ready to implement it. I still, in all honesty, feel a little bit anxious about it, but it was nice to have this kind of reinforcement on there.
And this is for estrogen, progesterone combos?
Correct. And then she did talk a lot about the contraindications. So in the cases that it's contraindicated, her recommendation was to do either norethindrone acetate or the methoxyprogesterone acetate pills. Essentially, for the norethindrone, you're doing 10 milligrams daily until the bleeding stops, and then going down to 5 milligrams. Again, a specific recommendation I hadn't heard before. And then with the MPA, it's 10 milligrams daily for 14 days. And then you go to the typical progesterone only pill.
And that's for the same time course. That's for the 3 months.
So she did not, I believe, specifically talk about that. I think, again, she was talking more about first of all, because it's progesterone only, you would be doing it continually no matter what. or until you decide to stop it. So I think it's a little bit of a different time course, and this is not as different from the typical doses. So I think it's just in perpetuity or until you decide to do something else.
Sorry, I'm kind of curious. Did she mention like using NSAIDs at all and like how we can go about that if we're not going to use?
She did. She briefly touched upon the NSAIDs. I don't have the dose in front of me, but I believe that it's 600 milligrams TID of ibuprofen or 500 BID of naproxen. I'd have to fact check that, but she did talk about it. I think she said for 3 to 5 days, if I remember correctly.
Okay. And did she say that there was like a preference or like how to go about choosing for which patient to do like OCPs versus NSAIDs?
So she didn't say that specifically. I think her point was that OCPs are going to be the most effective in most cases. If you're, I mean, a lot of it depends on what the cause is, right? If you're dealing with a bleeding disorder, then treating the underlying bleeding disorder is obviously the issue. But if you're talking about something that's causing anovulatory cycles, that is more from a GYN perspective, the OCP is going to be the most effective option in a patient for whom they're open to it and it's not contraindicated. But that already leads you down a limited path. And I don't remember if we referred to this in the episode, but the MEC, I think it's from the CDC, the medical eligibility criteria, is a fantastic tool for determining what options are available for a given patient with any particular condition. And you can kind of go across the birth control methods by their condition to determine what's safe for you.
And there's a CDC app for that, by the way, that I love. CDC has a couple good apps. That's one of them.
So what about rebuilding iron stores? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I loved her point on this as well, because it was contrary to my current practice. So I love anything that is going to change what I do. And she obviously recommended supplementing with oral iron or IV iron in very significant cases. But she suggested if you're doing oral iron, waiting until the bleeding has stopped. Because as we know, oral iron can be very upsetting to the GI tract, and you don't want that to be the reason that they stop everything and they don't get the initial problem under control. So she said once the bleeding stopped, then she puts them on iron. She normally does ferrous gluconate 650 milligrams daily with a stool softener.
So she does recommend daily dosing on that.
She does. She didn't talk about QOD dosing, which I don't have a, you know, it wasn't a big portion of this lecture. I think that many hematologists are doing the QOD.
Yeah. That's mostly because of hepcidin and induction and trying to minimize GI side effects. But I think many of us either do daily or every other day dosing.
My practice is a little bit different. I do daily dosing and just say it's okay if you skipped one accidentally. That's really what it comes down to.
Sometimes I mean, especially easier in adolescent medicine, it's usually a good idea to tell them what the ideal is and then
and what I'm okay with. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Realizing that that might actually work same or better. But
exactly right. That's exactly right.
But to the point on what hematologists recommended, she did bring in one point that she had learned from her hematology colleagues, which is that in her practice, based on the recommendations of hematology, any ferritin less than 50, they treat as being iron deficiency. So even though a lot of the reference ranges on labs will be lower than that, I think mine is less than 35 gets flagged, she does recommend looking for that less than 50 as a decision to treat tool.
I wonder if there are certain thresholds that need to be met if you're especially thinking about IV iron transfusions. So I know different insurances, it may matter. So, but I guess if it's only 50 and you want to try oral, I think that seems reasonable.
Yeah, I mean, she didn't talk about the thresholds there. And again, this was all within the hemoglobin of 8 to 11 range. I imagine that the decision to do iron IV is partially based on the tolerance and partially based on the symptoms. Like there's a lot of other factors that come into play that were probably beyond the scope.
Are there any other supplements besides iron that can be thought of in these cases?
So for the iron deficiency, I'm not sure, but she did talk about the dysmenorrhea component of this. So this has all been about heavy menstrual bleeding, but obviously the treatments above, especially the combined OCPs, are very helpful for dysmenorrhea. But she was talking about supplements, which is also something I flagged because I do have a lot of patients who are anxious about starting a birth control pill for good reason. It's for many people the first medication that they would be taking every day, and that can be overwhelming. So some of the supplements that she recommended and she provided specific doses for included vitamin B1, magnesium, vitamin E, and omega-3s. And it was very cool to see these laid out as these all have enough evidence. I think she said that they're listed on the Cochrane website for primary dysmenorrhea. So definitely something I'm going to offer to my patients going forward.
And they sound innocuous for someone who's never been taking medications before. I think
exactly.
That seems reasonable.
Yeah. I really like that when people give us like true clinical pearls that we can actually go put into practice. This is the dose. This is the number. This is the thing you're going to do. Go give it a shot and let's see what happens.
Maybe I'll throw it in the show notes for listeners. I'm not going to recite numbers to you all because that's incredibly boring.
Yeah, but check out our show notes.
Yeah. Although I was like, sometimes magnesium gives people some significant GI side effects too, so something to keep in mind.
True.
Hey, Cripsetters listeners, let's talk some more about Freed. Freed is an AI scribe that listens, transcribes, and writes medical documentation for you. So here's the backstory. Gabby, a family medicine physician, and Erez, a computer engineer, came up with Freed, a solution that could help alleviate the daily burden of overworked clinicians everywhere. And for Erez, selfishly, it could mean that he would spend more time with Gabby, who was spending nights, weekends, and holidays updating medical documentation. So what does Freed do? Freed turns clinicians' daily workflow into accurate documentation instantly. There's no training time, no onboarding, no extra mental burden. All the magic happens in just a few clicks, so clinicians can spend less energy on charting and more time on what they do best. Today, more than 4,000 clinicians and their spouses have fallen in love with Freed. So Freed is this AI scribe that makes charting go away, doing your soap notes for you. It is HIPAA compliant, takes 30 seconds to learn, and costs only $99 per month. But you can try Freed for free right now by going to freed.ai. That's freed.ai. And listeners of Cribsiders can use code CRIB50 for $50 off their first month.
Anything else from that talk that you want to talk about?
One really quick thing. She put in a plug for the Center for Young Women's Health, which I did check out the website, and it is a really fantastic resource for patients on a variety of common GYN disorders. It seems to be available pretty comprehensively in both English and Spanish. So adding that to my arsenal of things to do when I don't have enough time to really explain to patients how well I would like to explain things to them.
Getting resources like that really warms my heart.
Ooh, that's his transition, Abram. That's his transition.
A beautiful transition.
Abram and I went to a session on, what was it? Something to do with hearts.
We went to a heart murmur talk by Peter Sampatakis. He's a pediatric and fetal cardiologist at Johns Hopkins All Children's Hospital. And it was a nice talk. I think it was there's a lot of the requisite physics that some of us really love, that some of us, you know, might wish they didn't have to know, but it was really nice. I think the big thing, of course, he did go through, you know, various heart sounds, what means what, how can you know, identify some pathology? But really, there was a lot of it to empower general pediatricians and primary care providers to auscultate more and feel comfortable. One, you know, have a low threshold to refer, such that they're not scared to send a kid to the cardiologist, but also that they are able to identify things that may be benign. Something that he taught, and then I teach a variation that I've learned from one of my mentors, is one, palpating pulses when you're listening, so you can really identify S1, S2. Because oftentimes you're listening and I hear a lub dub, but you can make it go either way. You can bend those sounds in your mind. But one of my mentors also taught me kind of listen up at the bass, and your S2 will be louder when you have those aortic and pulmonic valves closing. But a lot of that is identifying, you know, where those sounds are occurring and what's causing them. So went through several cases that were really nice on murmurs, and then some that were not murmurs but were still pretty critical congenital heart disease, you know, where you don't have that turbulent flow, where you might have some large lesion, or you might have, you know, a single ventricle that doesn't have any sort of turbulent flow. That's gonna still be a pretty sick kid that requires a lot of interventions.
Okay, so this is more of a teaser, but he did agree to come on the show to talk about cardiac murmurs. So we might be able to have him on to talk about this even more fully.
Yeah, I think that's great. I think one of the big things is that, well, murmurs are common in lots of kids, but then there's a threshold of when you might take it a little bit more seriously. Not that you would ever take it lightly, but for newborns, the incidence is common, like 1%. But he's had some studies of various ranges, but a third to 86% might have an underlying congenital heart disease of varying severities. But being that they've only had, you know, days to weeks of life, they're not necessarily caught at that point.
So that means, as a cardiologist, he recommends that we do echoes on every single child.
on every single child. He pointed to an American Family Physician recommendation for ordering echoes or considering referral to cardiologists for newborns, even if they're asymptomatic, particularly in the newborn phase where you might have a high pulmonary resistance where you might not be starting to over-circulate. So if you don't have a murmur, you have a newborn. I mean, that's a reasonable period at which you might want to refer because they can be caught a little bit earlier.
That was a grade B recommendation, if I remember correctly.
It was, but I think the biggest thing was, you know, further teaching on, you know, Poussé's law, but then also a little bit of how to empower us to listen. So I think that was really nice. So I'm really looking forward to his future talk.
It is really hard. I will say, you know, I always made this joke, but in residency, you know, you go in the cardiology rotation and you're behind a cardiologist who's backing you up to listen to the heart and you're like, oh yeah, that's a Still's murmur. Oh, that's PPS, no problem. You know, and then you go in your own primary care clinic and you're like, I don't have a cardiologist to come in after me to listen. My confidence just dropped from, you know, 75% down to zero. You know, the other day, I will say, I asked for an echocardiogram from a cardiologist for what turned out to be PPS. It's, you know, what can we do to empower us to feel confident, not just, you know, knowing what the sounds are, I think is really challenging too.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of it does, you know, rely on symptoms too, like how the kids are doing. So, but you know, you can have kids who are doing well until all of a sudden they're not.
Yeah.
But really, really and truly the recommendation for him was just refer. If you have any concern, you're unsure, just refer. I think it's a low threshold too. I think what was important in his talk, one, you might want to do some counseling on what a murmur is. So you hear an abnormal heart sound in a child, a newborn, you might be more concerned for some serious underlying disease, but maybe a Still's murmur where you're not sure it's a Still's murmur, but you send them to a cardiologist, oh, my kid has a problem with their heart, right? So I think, you know, when I see them in my clinic with the cardiologist, I have to do some explanation. Like, what have you heard before? What did they tell you about this? Is your impression that you're going to need open heart surgery? And many times, no, especially for these, you know, these teenagers. So I think that's a big thing. So one, you know, one, being able to listen, be confident in what you're hearing, what sounds obviously like a problem, and if you're unsure, send, and then just kind of give a little bit of explanation. So you could tell the family, hey, I have your 2 month old. I hear something. I could be concerned they have an underlying condition, or you could say it might be nothing, but I want to get it checked out by someone who knows a little bit more better,
and more eloquent. No, actually, that was one of my favorite parts of his talk is how he explains how he talks to parents. Because I think one of the things he was like, oh, you know, we hear murmur at 2-3 months, but then parents are upset that, wait, how come they didn't hear the murmur when the baby was born? And just being able to explain, you know, physiology is a little different, pressures change in the heart after a couple months. So there wasn't necessarily that people miss this, it's just the physiologically things change. And so I think those are my favorite parts out of this talk, outside of just being able to rehash like some good murmurs. It was good.
To the point on the 2-3 month old who has a sudden murmur that you didn't hear before or no one had caught before, does that fall under that newborn recommendation that you should kind of always refer because the risk for structural heart disease is higher? Maybe that's
curveball. This recommendation specifically talks about newborns, but I think anyone in infancy, I would probably have a very low threshold to send.
The way he described it, for any under 1 year of age that you have any concerns, you should.
Do you want me to go next?
Neffy!
No brand names.
Oh, sorry.
Intranasal epinephrine.
Yeah. Well, so everybody,
I've had enough of you.
I will say this was not a talk, but I did actually go learn a little bit about intranasal epinephrine.
So you didn't lose your soul going on the exhibit floor?
I may have. Well, I don't think I sold anything because I didn't purchase anything, but I did want to let you guys know a little bit about intranasal epinephrine. So for those that aren't aware, on August 9th, the FDA approved intranasal epinephrine for type 1 hypersensitivity allergic reaction, similarly to intramuscular epinephrine. And this is the first, at least FDA approved version of epinephrine that does not involve a needle into a child's leg. And so that was the big thing that everyone's kind of talking about. And so I at least just wanted to go learn more about the medicine and how it works and at least how it's dosed, how it's given, how it's prescribed, all those types of things, just in case we're interested in doing that. And so I'm going to try not to use brand names during this, but I do want to recognize...
Well, there's only one.
I do want to recognize that there is only one brand right now that is, because it was just FDA approved, and this company is probably feeling very good about themselves. But in the meantime, yes, it is intranasal epinephrine given at 2 milligrams a dose rather than our 0.3 milligrams that comes in the IM form. So the way it's actually dosed and given is the exact same nasal actuator as the intranasal naloxone, also brand name Narcan. That one is, it literally looks identical. It has the exact same kind of squeeze button in the bottom, and it goes directly into the nose, and it's a single dose that's to be given. It has a small medicine that essentially starts vasodilating the vessels in the nose that helps absorption of medicines just the same way the intranasal naloxone does. It's given once, and then if you don't have any response, you wait 5 minutes, and then you can readminister, and it can be the same nostril. That's okay. It is given it should be prescribed in a two-pack, similarly to your IM kind of prescription. And then the key is, as well, is that can be stored anywhere. It could even be frozen, although you do have to wait till it defrosts so the stuff can then mist again.
Might be a little difficult.
Yeah, it's not going to mist if it's frozen, but it can survive being frozen. It can survive, I think, temperatures over 110 degrees, if not higher than that. So it actually is a pretty safe place or a pretty safe medicine for long-term use. And they said it actually lasts for about 30 months. You would expect that it's probably been 6 months in the whole production pharmacy phase. You really got 24 months since you get it kind of from the pharmacy.
And you can use the same dose for kids and adults because,
Thank you for clarifying.
The IM version, you always have like that, the junior version.
Thank you for clarifying. Yeah, right now this is only approved for kids that are 30 kilos and up.
Okay.
So that's looking at school age kids and over. They do have a submission to the FDA for kids that are younger than that, but it has not yet been FDA approved. So right now this is only 30 kilos and up in a single dose, just like the adult IM epinephrine. And so the brand name EpiPen epinephrine would be 25 kilos and up, and that is a just for everyone above that, where brand name EpiPen Junior would be for lower than that. So we don't have the quote-unquote EpiPen Junior version of this drug just yet.
Because I have immense respect for you as Dr. Mazur.
Uh-oh.
Did this get you comfortable enough that you feel like you would be ready to start prescribing it in place of the EpiPen?
Yeah, so that's a great question because this was actually when I learned about this medicine, it was not, and this is the review article, and let me be very clear to everybody, this is not a journal presentation for the review article that came in the FDA approval and that came out of the Journal of Allergy, I think, in Immunology. So do I think that would go? I mean, I think I would prescribe it just because the FDA approved it, and like I have to run at least with the FDA right now, and I'm not good enough at primary literature to be like, oh, let me see exactly how this went. So right now I would try it, and I think we're going to find out a lot of data afterwards, depending on all that, you know, all our doctors who are prescribing it these days.
I mean, if it's the size of like the intranasal naloxone,
yeah,
these things are small compared to like any type of IM. Those are like the syringes. Like I see it much easier to put it in a bag, especially for my adolescents and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And so I hope it's going to be just as effective. But right now the FDA says it is. So we'll go with them until they somehow renege on this one. And I think I wanted to mention one other piece is how to actually get it in prescription. Right now, pharmacies are not stocking this. I will say the company recommended their own like online pharmacy, which is going to be discounted to patients and families and will give essentially a prescription for while filling out paperwork for $25. But that is not going to be how much this is going to cost over the counter. I don't want to necessarily promote certain pharmacies and certain things, so I'm not going to exactly say how that is, but I would imagine we might be able to get this for $25 versus what happens with our insurance companies later on.
And to be clear, it would be controversial to use these in newborns, right?
That is 100% correct, based on the fact that no newborn I know is over 30 kilos.
Do we have any other controversies in newborns?
Oh, what a great transition.
I'm ready
See,
for
I'm good,
that.
I'm good I'm at good. This.
You're getting better. So I went to a talk called What's Trending in the Newborn Nursery, Controversies and Evidence. And it was given by Dr. Markowski from Children's National and Dr. Gupta from Stanford. And I was kind of interested in this talk because last year I worked as a pediatric hospitalist, but we also had to cover the newborn nursery. And I feel like my approach to newborn nursery is like a checklist of like Hep B vaccine, check, car seat text, check, like check, 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 check. And so I was kind of curious to hear what their commentary was going to be. And so fortunately I walked in a little bit late, but I did catch their thing about, they referenced the 2022 bilirubin guidelines who they said has higher thresholds for when to start phototherapy. And it's also their guidelines and flow sheets are a little bit more delineated by gestational age as well as neurotoxicity risk factors. And it decreases the number of babies that have to go under phototherapy decreases length of stay without actually increasing complications from hyperbilirubinemia. So I don't know the details of these guidelines, but recommend that we all go check them out.
Don't we have a Billy episode?
We have two Billy episodes.
There you go.
Part one and a part two.
Well, shoot.
Yeah, we talked about the Billy tool and everything.
Absolutely. Although
there is integration into certain electronic medical records too with the new guidelines.
That's true. That is true.
Oh, which certain
that
ones?
I may,
you know,
may or not.
I can't speak to brand
names. Yeah, we don't know brand names and medical records here.
Anything else?
Yes, we have a couple other things that they talked about. One was the car seat challenge. And so that is definitely one of the ones that I just like check. Are they preterm and low birth weight? Mm-hmm. But so they, you know, this car seat challenge came about in, I think they said the 90s, because there's this concern that preterm infants are at higher risk for apnea. And so the official recommendation is to do car seat testing for all babies who are less than 37 weeks. One point they made was that when they look at hospital guidelines, there's a huge variation as to like how people actually enact car seat testing in the newborn nursery, and then how they even interpret car seat testing, be that like their SAT thresholds or what do they do when a baby fails the car seat test. But they talked about a 2023 retrospective cohort study that was done in Kaiser, who had actually discontinued car seat testing in 2016, and they compared what the rates of death, 911 calls, readmission, apnea, bruise, within 30 days of discharge before this was discontinued and afterwards, and actually found that there was no increase in any of these poor outcomes, which I thought was great. And I feel like I don't know if I'm allowed to in my hospital system, but I kind of want to get rid of that as like my checklist when I see newborns. The other thing I thought was interesting is Canada has already like gone, I can't remember what year, they actually discontinued. They don't do car seat testing anymore, which I thought was pretty interesting.
Did they touch on whether or not you're doing them? Some institutions still continue to do them for various gestational ages and weights. But what if the infant fails the car seat test? Did she talk about that?
So they didn't actually talk about it, except for that there's a lot of question as to what to do with it. Because they did these like cute little case presentation, or like when they did their case presentations. I'm trying to remember. This one was, I think they used Star Wars as their characters. Not relevant to this teaching point, but they were like, what happens if they fail? And like, you repeat it. Okay, but they fail again. And they're like, okay, like repeat it. And it's like, but we don't really know what to do when they keep failing and failing. Like, when can they actually go home? Yeah.
Wait, what does this have to start do with Star Wars? I completely missed.
I don't know. They're just using names. They were just being cute.
Oh, I see. I was waiting for like the Star Wars reference. Like if they fail, you have to use the Force or something.
We're just pediatricians.
No. Just using characters.
Gotcha.
The next topic that they touched on was RSV, which I know there was a huge hype on the RSV vaccine. And so
check out the episode.
Yes, check out the episode. So the punchline is all infants are recommended to be protected by either the maternal RSV vaccine or get the monoclonal antibody. And I'm going to botch the name, nirsevimab. Anybody else have a better pronunciation?
That's perfect. That's
great. We should give that. So we should be giving that for infants who are less than 8 months, whose mom did not get the vaccine at least 14 days before birth. So I thought that was pretty good concrete guidelines there. There's also AAP guidelines that you can reference with a beautiful flow sheet as well. And I also thought a really important point is that I know last year there was this huge hassle of people who wanted the vaccine, he couldn't get the vaccine. And this year, they're not anticipating a supply-demand mismatch. So for anybody who's curious, the next topic that they touched on was NOWS,
Now we're talking about NOWS.
Now's the time to talk about NOWS.
Also, shout out, check out our NOWS episode.
There you go.
Yeah, that's what I call
so
NOWS.
Many episodes to check out. So they started off with pointing out there has been a pretty drastic increase in number of moms who are using opioids during pregnancy. So this is a pretty relevant topic to talk about. But they just reviewed several studies that were comparing protocols using the Finnegan scoring system and using medications to treat NOWS versus the Eat, Sleep, Console protocol, I guess you could say. So just for the listeners who aren't familiar, so basically for the Eat, Sleep, and Console, you just like ask yes or no questions about are they eating well, which is defined as at least 1 ounce of feed, 1 ounce per feed or breastfeeding well. 2, are they sleeping well? Are they sleeping undisturbed for at least 1 hour? Or 3, if they are crying, can you console them within 10 minutes? And if the babies aren't meeting this, the big push is to have non-pharmacologic interventions. So oftentimes for the babies who are in the hospital, it involves like nursing or parents kind of wrapping them, consoling them, rocking them. Or if that's unsuccessful, then you go into morphine. And so they referenced two different studies. So there was a 2023 multi-centered RCT that actually looked at 1,300 infants and found that the eat, sleep, console kind of pathway decreased length of stay. And then there was a follow-up 2024 study that found that there actually was a decreased mean opioid exposure, decreased length of stay when you did the eat, sleep, console pathway. Even though that the mean time to initiating opioids was longer. So even if like you didn't start treating with medications till several hours later, I don't remember the exact numbers, the length of stay was still shorter, which I thought was kind of interesting.
I'm speechless, almost as if I was tongue-tied.
So that's our last point there. I think there was a lot of news articles about tongue tie that came out once the AAP like published their guidelines. So for tongue tie, they start off by saying there's been an increased frequency of tongue tie diagnoses as well as frequencies of frenotomies, but that it's important for us as pediatricians to realize that most breastfeeding issues aren't really related to tongue tie. And so they made a really big point that a huge slide that said we should be concerned about symptomatic ankyloglossia, tongue tie. And so they define that as a tight lingual frenulum that restricts tongue range of motion that can cause breastfeeding difficulties, and it is not improved for lactation support. And it should only be for symptomatic tongue tie that we should actually be doing these frenotomies for, not just because they have tongue tie, not because they even mentioned the buccal as well as the, forgetting the medical word for lips, but
lingual.
Labial ties. Yes.
And do you know if symptomatic is defined as poorly breastfeeding or actual poor weight gain?
That's a great question. They did not define it by poor weight gain. Yeah. Yeah. And then they also made a point to say that by doing a frenotomy, you're not actually preventing issues such as like speech or OSA. It's purely for feeding. And this post-op stretching is not evidence-based as well, which I didn't know we did. But yes, it's not evidence-based.
Did she say anything about the process for identifying a tongue tie on exam? Like I've heard it has to do with if the tongue can extend beyond the lower lip. Did she talk about, is there anything more effective in terms of being able to look at one?
That's a great question. I've heard that too. But no, she didn't go into that. She just said that like if you're concerned about it, you should do a pretty extensive history and physical history to thinking about what their prenatal history is, what their breastfeeding or feeding history is, and then just physical exam to look at it, and then to look at mom's breasts, nipples to see how they latch, and then to trial lactation support before moving on to doing the frenotomy.
And there's one interesting thing that I feel like comes up a lot, and they probably didn't touch on this, but I just wanted to put it out there to the group, is that so lactation specialists will not be able to tell you if you're quote unquote officially diagnose you with this issue, but they will often tell you that they think this is a concern, which I think comes back to you as a pediatrician when someone comes in, oh, my lactation person told me that this was a concern. If I'm a pediatrician, I'll be like, okay, that sounds real. You know, like it's hard, you know, I trust them to do that, which I think is a little bit nuanced. And so I just wanted to put that out there. I don't know exactly how I feel about that and whether who should be making this diagnosis, who should be saying this patient's symptomatic, but obviously we work as a multidisciplinary team, so something to talk about as a group.
Also, we can talk about as a group is about triglycerides. I had no way.
That one was rough.
No comments on that one then. All right, we'll leave that as is. It's getting late. Abram, did you happen to go to a final session?
I did go to one session. I went to a triglyceride talk by Justin Zechariah. He's a pediatric and preventative cardiologist at Texas Children's. He gave a great talk on triglycerides, primarily touched on some other conditions as well. Big takeaway really was our universal screening. So a lot of the times, we'll be in clinic, we'll see kids, I want to get some labs on them. They're 9 to 11 years old. I want to follow the AAP guidelines. And someone will go, oh, they're not that overweight. They're not that obese. They don't have high. There was in the NHANES data set, they did a study looking at these kids. And there was an increased percentage in the last several decades of overweight and obese children, but actually a decrease in the percentage of children with low HDL and a decrease in the percentage of high non-HDL cholesterol, high LDL or VLDL cholesterol. He didn't really have a great explanation for why that was the case, but kind of the takeaway when they did the math of it all, there's a significant portion, 30 to 40% of children who have high triglycerides who are not overweight. So really and truly, the if we're not implementing universal screening, we are missing a large percentage of kids. There was some data about cumulative hazard over time as well, talking about risk factors. So if a child has abnormal labs, has dyslipidemia, but then normalizes by adulthood, they look just like someone who's always had normal labs. And, you know, that might be some extent intuitive, but really not. If you look at, they looked at some autopsies of military people and then who died, who had plaques in their various vessels as teenagers, as young adults. So it really nice to see that the risk is similar to a person who never had abnormal lipids. There is some paucity of data though on how we look at, you know, if a child has abnormal or has dyslipidemia on their adult outcomes. But really the big takeaway was it probably does matter. So the USPSTF guideline talked about insufficient data to discuss the benefits and harms of screening for lipids in children and adolescents 20 years and younger. But when he pointed us to the references for this, and really it seems like it does matter, and it does kind of follow some sort of logic. So the big things were to really follow those guidelines pretty universally, so you're not missing those kids who are not overweight, who may still have a dyslipidemia. Another big thing being, if he's saying that one in five kids has high triglycerides, really contextualizing it for the kids that really matter. So he was kind of telling us, in a class of, if you have a class of 35 children, you're going to have one in five are going to have high triglycerides. You're going to have seven kids in a class. He's like, you know, it's a whole row of children who are going to have this to some degree. And further, that maybe a third of those are going to be not overweight children. So really helping normalize some of this. There was some talk on therapies, and for triglycerides specifically, the data is not really there for preventing cardiovascular events in adults, or in children who have high triglycerides when they get onto adulthood. But, you know, I think sometimes as pediatricians, we are even a little hesitant to start medications that may end up being lifetime medications. But if you have a child who has dyslipidemia, I mean, all you're doing by starting at this age is you're preventing a later outcome or a bad outcome later on.
And did he say about dietary treatment versus statins?
Not versus statins in this case. This is mostly a triglyceride talk, but he did talk about really what they try to do is just increase whole grains and increase more fish and more omega-3s from fish rather than supplementation. The supplementation really wasn't great for kids, and it wasn't approved for kids. The big thing being that when you focus on, you know, these more whole grain diets, you're going to eat less of the other stuff. Talked about reducing or eliminating sugar sweetened beverages. He said in practice, he has kids with high triglycerides. They eliminate that. That's the one change they make, and their levels plummet. So really that's the biggest thing right now. But you know, for specific conditions, so if you did have high cholesterol, we should not necessarily be scared of these medications. At that point, he didn't discuss this, but at that point, I don't know if I'd probably send him off to someone to actually to initiate that. And that was similar to the other talk, is they do this their entire practice. So sending another kid who has abnormal labs, if they have abnormal labs, they'll see them. Yeah. And they'll gladly see them.
I think actually it's a really interesting point that you made about the eliminating sugary beverages. So for example, we're supposed to show up at general pediatricians, talk about the 5-2-1 rule, 5-2-1-0 rule, and like go through and try to eliminate sugary beverages, and then they're not listening, but you have an abnormal lab all of a sudden, and you're like, oh, all right, now I'm going to stop and I'm going to start doing this, and then I'm going to recheck this lab and it's better, and then you have some data point to prove it. I don't know if how much bias goes into that, but I think it's worth just also commenting on.
Well, there was a little bit too. So he would say for children who might have an abnormal A1C, you get that lab on their initial visit. You're not doing counseling at that point. You're sending the lab, you're having them come back when the lab results, and then you're saying, well, look, your A1C is this. On a subsequent visit, it may not change. But then at that point, you could say, what have you been doing to maintain this? It's not gotten worse. If it's gotten better, fantastic as well. I mean, like that's the ideal outcome. But then you have someone who's hooked, who has a tangible goal. So you see that they've either maintained where they're at or they've improved. And then you can kind of talk about, well, these lipids might be abnormal as well. You've already done such a good job with this other metric. Why don't we try and work on this as well?
Avery, one question about testing. So I know most of us are probably screening starting around age 9 to 11, at least to look for these familial type of hypercholesterolemias, hypertriglyceridemias. Did they say anything about whether it should be fasting versus non-fasting? I know that's probably the thing that affects our testing the most, and especially as you start treating them, whether with lifestyle or other types of ways, like I assume follow-up lipid panels should be done fasting.
So that's one thing that was important, and it was actually interesting when he commented on it. So ideally, when you're getting that first set, it is fasting. Now we know some of these levels might have a little bit more, like your triglycerides might vary more with your diet and the time of day. So ideally, if you can get a fasting, get a really truly clean sample at that point, that's really important. The big takeaway was when you're doing it in later adolescence and 18, 19 years old, just get what you can get because you're sending them on to adulthood. They might not get another lab. Particularly if you send them to like a commercial lab, they might not get it done. So at that point, get what you can. At that point, they've also probably kind of fallen into more their like adult eating habits, and it's better just to know where they're at.
Right. It's just so hard to get those people in the afternoon. You know, the poor kid who's missed breakfast and then lunch and is cranky by the afternoon.
Like, oh, and can I poke your veins?
Yeah, exactly. So, all right, that's good to know.
A couple of quick questions about lab logistics. The first is, I guess, kind of coming off of that, did he say anything about when he typically repeats? Like, what is the amount of time that he typically lets lapse? And then I'm also curious if there's a difference in how we should be approaching people with isolated hypertriglyceridemia compared to people who have both hypercholesterolemia and high triglycerides. Just it feels inherently to me that there would be higher risk with the combination, but I'm not sure if that is actually borne out in pediatrics.
I can answer the first question from my head, but the other one I'd have to look more into. So really the thing is you can screen as early as 2 years old if you're concerned. So if you have a strong family history or if a child's particularly overweight or something like that, or they're, you know, for whatever reason you're concerned, you can get labs at that point. If they're normal, he recommended screening every 3 to 5 years until they're either abnormal or they're never abnormal. At that point, if they're abnormal, then you can go ahead, initiate lifestyle treatment, initiate medications if needed. You know, ideally if they're trending up or there's interventions to be made, you're making the interventions along the way. You're not waiting until then. But that was the recommendation for that.
The isolated hypertriglyceridemia compared with if it's in combination with cholesterol abnormalities.
Well, I would say when you're looking at those cases, they might be a completely different type of phenotype, right? So I think those with high triglycerides and high LDL, you're thinking more of a mixed hyperlipidemia. Whereas, you know, I think a lot of children, they're coming in with just a single like hypertriglyceridemia. That I feel like those are probably more of a hereditary type picture. Whereas you maybe see a mix in, you know, maybe our overweight children who are also like diabetics and so forth. So I think they're just completely different phenotypes, but I can't say for sure.
The new number is. This has been another episode of the Cribsiders.
It's for the kids!
Get show notes and sign up for our weekly knowledge food formula feeds newsletter on our website at thecribsiders.com.
So we're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge, and to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts or contact us at thecribsiders@gmail.com. Special thanks to putting this all together, our producer, Dr. Joan Park, and our wonderful social media team on X and Instagram. Thank you for all who traveled to Orlando for this episode and to listen to us. I've been Sam Mazur.
I've been Avram Rago.
I've been Sydney Engel.
I've been Joan Park.
And this has been Chris the G-Man Chew. Thank you. Good night.